This is an Equity Beats Media podcast.
Everything you're about to hear is for education and entertainment purposes only. Whilst we are licensed, we're not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any advice is general advice. Equity Mates operates under Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is
equity. Welcome back to Equity Mates Investing, a podcast where we explore what's possible in the world of investing. If you've just joined us for the first time, a huge welcome. My name is Bryce, and today we're doing a deep dive on the resources sector and looking at a stock that might surprise you. To chat it through, as always, I'm joined by my equity buddy, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. Very excited for this interview. We're about to speak to Joe Wright, who's a senior equities analyst at Airlie Funds Management. Airlie have an ASX-listed fund, the Airlie Australian Shares Fund. ASX ticker is... AASF.
Performs well, I know that.
There you go. We should congratulate Joe on that. Yeah. But as you said, we are doing all things resources and materials here. But the stock that we're talking about isn't a miner.
No.
It's, I guess, a picks and shovels play to the mining industry. So an interesting one.
Yeah, can't wait. In today's episode, we're going to speak through the investing process that Joe goes through at Airlie. And then, as Ren said, do a bit of a deep dive on a stock that is... in part of the fund at the moment. So we're really looking forward to this one. We should say a big thank you to Airlie for sponsoring this episode and supporting Equity Mates, allowing us to continue to provide free content for the Equity Mates community. But with that said,
let's do it.
Let's crack in. Well, Joe, welcome to Equity Mates.
No dramas. Thanks for having me.
So, Joe, we're going to spend a bit of time unpacking your journey in finance and what you're doing at Airlie, and then turn to discussion around the resources sector.
Cool.
Now, we want to kick off with a bit of a fun fact we learned about you. In fact, you and I have a bit of a shared common background here. Before, okay. I'm not involved in the finance industry, so to speak. I do a finance. Yeah. I feel like podcast.
Finance adjacent.
Finance adjacent. But we both started in arts.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So you started doing a history major and then a Master's of Art Curation at UNSW. I started a Bachelor of Music in Performance in Classical Percussion.
Yep.
And here we both find ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happened?
No, it's a good question. Yeah, I did a Bachelor of Commerce Liberal Studies. It was a good degree because you got to do an arts major or an arts or science. I'm not good at science, so I did arts. And I loved art history. I loved art in general. And that was my favourite part of that degree. And then I went travelling and I was sort of like, oh, what am I going to do next? How am I going to find my way? And I found this Masters of Art Curation at COFA, which is now UNSW Art and Design. And I enrolled in it and I dropped out after 3 months because I didn't really like it. Ended up, putting the suit on and getting into finance, which is a bit of a twist. But, I love maths and I thought it was just a great way to sort of apply that part of my brain.
It's a big step from art curation to funds management.
Yeah.
How did you find, I guess, why funds management?
I had people in my life who exposed me to that industry, so I always knew it was a pathway, whereas some people come up through university and maybe naturally fall towards these large accounting firms or consultancy firms. I always knew funds management was out there and a super interesting job. I think taking a step back, I always found the democracy of the stock market very interesting. It's anyone can start an account. Anyone can, put $1,000 into some of the world's great companies. And then the idea on top of that other people were better than others and other people have an edge and other people could do better work and prove themselves, through their returns that they were superior, I think always interested me. I'm competitive and, it's an industry where you get to follow your nose and do deep dive research, but also it is a competitive industry where, people get proven to be good or bad, and I think there's something really exciting in that.
Mm. Now, of all the sectors you could specialize in, there's a lot of sexy ones out there.
Yeah, yeah.
You've gone for something that I guess Australians find sexy, which is resources.
Yeah.
Why resources?
Well, it's a funny one. I mean, you know, you can probably tell from looking at me, I'd never been to a mine. Yeah. I'd actually never been to Western Australia, to be honest. And I'm sure a lot of people I did the art history course would probably, you know, look down on me for being so actively involved in resources now. But personally, you know, it was, you know, I joined early. That was a sector where an analyst had just left. You know, Matt and Emma asked me if I'd like to take it over, and I sort of jumped at the opportunity because, you know, it is a really important sector in Australia. It's a big sector, lots of interesting companies, and, you know, and frankly, it's a very necessary sector. It's political, it's got a lot of characters in it, it's, you know, hugely profitable at points in the cycle, and there's some really good investments as a result. So yeah, now I've been to heaps of mines and been to WA all the time, and it's great.
Favourite mine?
Favourite mine. I tell you what, I went down Cadia, which was Newcrest or now Newmont's gold mine, and man, we drove like 30 minutes before we got to the to the sort of underground control room, and I was so claustrophobic, but it was pretty amazing. Yeah, I was just chugging the waters the whole time.
Joe, how would you define your investing philosophy?
I'd like to sit here and say I like grew up, you know, smashing the Warren Buffett notes and all of those sorts of things, but the fact is, you know, I've only read a handful of these investing books, and a few of them, the ones that really resonated me were guys like Howard Marks, and, you know, I even got my hands on a PDF of Seth Klarman's, you know, book. And the thing that resonated to me about those guys is it's like about buying a dollar for 50 cents. You know, it's about having a really big margin of safety in your investments such that, you know, if the downside case eventuates, you don't lose much money, and you're always pretty attractively positioned in any business. And I'd say that is inherently my philosophy. You know, at Airlie, we have a pretty strict investment process. It starts with balance sheet, then it goes business quality, management quality, and finally valuation. And valuation, of course, is last because it's a relative metric versus, you know, balance sheet, business quality, and management quality. And I think through that lens, you know, my philosophy still can come through as an analyst. I think on top of that, you know, resources, there are so many unknowns. You know, commodity cycles are really difficult to predict. Assets can not perform the way you expect them to. You know, they're inherently a moving feast as you get deeper into a mine and you unlock new things or discover new things about an asset. And so having that lens of, you know, an appropriate margin of safety, I'd say really rings true in the sector for me.
Yeah, it's a funny one when you think about like trying to apply that buying a dollar for 50 cents and having an appropriate margin of safety to an industry that is so, I guess, tied to commodity cycles and so many things like outside of the control of the company and the management team.
That's right.
You know, what, lithium's down, had an incredible bull run and then is down 90% this year. And trying to forecast that in your DCF and then try and buy a dollar for 50 cents. It's difficult.
It's so difficult, yeah.
So how do you do that day to day?
An interesting segue to maybe how I think about it is just, so before I was at Ely, I was at a place called Schroders, and I, you know, did 4 years there, and they gave me the gold sector. And the gold sector is this sector no one wants to cover, you know, like in Australia, basically, because it's so difficult to take a view on the price. And people don't even pretend to take a view on the price because it's not like what's the cost curve? What's the supply demand? It, you know, where's US inflation going? Where's US interest rates? Where's US dollars? All these, you know, other factors that influence the price. But I think the flip side of that is you're forced to really understand the quality of an asset. You know, it can't be as arbitrary as just being like, oh, lithium goes up, I'm going to buy all these lithium stocks. Like, you really need in gold to understand the quality of an asset, especially when you have such a loose view of price direction. And so, you know, funnily enough, covering that sector probably gave me a lot of foundation to then look at the resources sector more broadly and have that asset quality focus. Because you're right, like, there are so many known unknowns. And I think, you know, in the context of my investment philosophy, you know, when you're doing a DCF or trying to understand future cash flows of an asset, you just have to apply conservative assumptions, whether that's cost or whether that's commodity price. You know, when something stacks up under those conservative assumptions, you can feel like you are buying something maybe for 50 cents on the dollar. I think that's how I approach the sector.
So you mentioned the investment approach that you take at Airlie, which is balance sheet, quality of business, quality of management and valuation.
Yep.
A lot of those areas, there's probably things that we as retail investors can think about in our own approach to investing as well.
Yep.
So starting with balance sheet, like what are some of the key things that you're trying to tick off when it as part of that process?
Yeah. It's about where you think the balance sheet is relative to a level of mid-cycle earnings. So, you know, a lot of companies maybe get flack for, oh, look, the leverage looks high at this point in time, but perhaps the project fully isn't ramped up, or perhaps, you know, commodity prices are very low and that's not your expectation into mid-cycle. And so maybe the balance sheet isn't as stretched as people think. You know, on the flip side, you know, a company might have a lot of debt, but commodity prices are at all-time high and earnings are perhaps above mid-cycle. And so you think, oh, this thing looks fine. You know, when the tide goes out, you find out that they're perhaps too leveraged. Mm. And then, of course, you sort of want to understand the nature of the debt itself, if they have any. You know, what's the rate they're paying? What are the covenants? You know, how could this potentially result in a situation where they need to raise capital to pay off the debt holders?
And so then you talk about quality of company. So how does that differ to looking at like the financials of it?
Yeah. Quality of any resources company, I think, just comes back to the asset itself. And the asset, you know, is the resource. It's the grade. It's the life of mine. It's the cost per ton of production. You know, all these things are stuff you can understand with enough research, stuff you can compare to other assets really easily. That's the great thing about the resources sector is there's lots of mines in any given commodity. And so there's great transparency around cost. Because ultimately, what you're trying to find, I think, for a great long-term resources holding is companies where the cost of production will hold them, will allow them to earn an attractive return on capital through the cycle.
Mm.
And that's a function of generally where the asset sits on the cost curve, as well as, you know, the supply-demand outlook.
Mm. So balance sheet, quality of company. The third approach is quality of management.
Yeah.
So what are you looking for there?
Oh, management quality in resources, I think, is like the secret sauce.
Okay.
Like, there's a reason there's all these names in the sector that attract investors who you know, will follow them into any asset because of their track record. At Airlie, you'd know we're large shareholders in mineral resources. Mm. Again, there's a big management quality element there. We think Chris Ellison knows how to spend capital better than anyone else. We think he, you know, takes risk, the kind of risk we want him to take at points in the cycle, and he's a great project execution guy. He's delivered, you know, many projects on budget within the time frames he said he's going to. And so, yeah, I think that's management quality for resources. It's about auditing the track record of, you know, whoever's running the business, because it just tells you a lot about their style. It tells you a lot about how risk-averse or unaverse they are.
It's such a subjective metric, quality of management. And one way to kind of make it more objective is to look at someone's track record, because that's objective and provable.
Yeah.
But so many mining projects are early.
Yeah.
And they're people that don't perhaps have enough of a track record.
Yeah.
So do you just say if they don't have a track record, we're not investing? Or do you have other, I guess, tools to...
I mean, the really obvious tool, which, you know, is not something you want to necessarily rely on, but I think is super helpful, is how much of this company do they own themselves?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, if there are mining executives out there with large amounts of their own personal wealth in the company, you'd naturally have pretty good alignment, I think. Chris Ellison owns 12% of Mineral Resources, for example. I mean, that is just an objective metric for alignment that I think is really helpful. That argument of, you know, is this person the right person to build, take this resource from a few drill holes in the ground to, you know, a fully functioning project is really difficult. And it is probably the reason at Airlie, concentrated portfolio, quality names, we steer clear a lot of that sort of pre-production part of the market. Because again, like, it's really difficult to know all of the unknowns and then price a company accordingly.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
And then the final part of the approach is valuation, which you did touch on, but maybe just elaborate on what that actually means to you at Airlie. Like, is it deep value that you're looking for, or where do you sort of fall on the spectrum?
I've always found the most comfort in using a DCF to value mining companies because they're not perpetuities, a lot of them. You know, a lot of companies might have a 10-year life. Maybe there's, you know, optionality in the resource to extend that life, but these aren't ongoing businesses into perpetuity. And so just putting a multiple on any year of earnings sort of feels lazy, especially when, you know, the companies, most companies in the resources, frankly, give you heaps of disclosure around, you know, cost metrics, production metrics, future growth, things like that. Like I said before, you know, when you can build a DCF and layer in some conservative assumptions around the mine itself, as well as, you know, the commodity price outlook, and feel comfortable that, you know, with those assumptions in place, you're still getting a discount, you still be able to buy the company discounting valuation, you know, that's probably how we approach the sector.
Yeah, I think if you want to learn the art and skill of valuation, there's and DCFs in particular, there's no better industry to start with than the mining industry.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So speaking of learning, I guess, you know, people listening to this would probably see a lot of similarities to your life. You know, didn't study, well, you just studied art and art curation at uni.
Only for 3 months.
Went to a sector where you didn't have any specialized knowledge or experience, hadn't even been to a mine before, but hadn't even been to Western Australia when you picked up this sector. So you were really coming in pretty cold. For people who are in a similar situation but want to get better and learn more, what were some of the most valuable resources you found to upskill quickly?
Like, I think some people, you know, think of the mining sector as like this other way of investing or this other type of investment. Like, these are just businesses that produce cash flows and you value based on the future cash flow generation. And that's how people should think about them, like any other business. Do you know what I mean? You should just look at them like revenue, costs, cash flow. The only nuance being the sort of DCF element in that they are perhaps not perpetuities. Again, like when I was at Schroders, I was very fortunate enough to sit next to the head of research there who was also the resources analyst. You know, so I was able to soak up a lot of information that way. And I know, you know, that's not particularly helpful for people who don't work in the industry, but that was my journey.
Yeah.
I'd say for people, you know, retail investors, I think it's really simple stuff that goes a long way, like reading an annual report from front to back, you know, going through the quarterlies and listening to the calls. You know, the companies give a lot of great information on calls and you get to hear the sell side and hear how they're thinking about things. And, you know, while the sell side is a tool I use as well, the great thing about the mining sell side is actually a lot of them are ex-mining guys. They're guys who've covered this sector for a long time. And so hearing their questions gives good insight into, you know, the issues that they think are most important, the issues that any investor should be looking at. Beyond that, I can't sort of be any clearer how fortunate I am to be able to go and meet with management and see these mines. You know, I probably underestimated how much of a visual learner I was. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, what are you going to learn on a site visit? Like, frankly, seeing these things in person and how they all fit together was like unbelievably helpful and still is. And again, like, not super helpful for retail investors, but
that's all right. That's all right.
That's all I got.
Now, Jay, you said you covered the gold sector, and that's an asset class where we as retail investors are faced with a choice between buying the actual commodity or buying the producers of the commodity. So how do you think through that decision and, I guess, help us think through that?
Yeah. Firstly, that decision is made for us in that we can only buy companies. We can't buy the commodity purely. But, you know, for retail investors, what I would say is buying any resources commodity is this amazing way, I think, to get exposure to like big global structural trends. Like, if you are bullish, you know, the penetration of electric vehicles, buying lithium as a commodity is a great way to get exposure that way, because you're not faced with valuation risk on a company. You're not faced with asset risk. You're not faced with management risk. You are not faced with trying to pick the right electric vehicle company, for example. You get to buy a commodity that, you know, has very broad-based consumption, you know, outlook for that sector. And, you know, in the same way, buying iron ore is about the rise of the Chinese middle class and economic growth in places like China and India. Same with thermal and metallurgical coal. Buying copper, maybe you are bullish the electrification of the grid that needs to occur. You know, I think if you don't want to or can't get your head around the risks associated with buying an actual producer of the commodity, you know, buying the commodity as an exposure is a really great way to get aligned to those sorts of trends. You know, something like a good example is like Pilbara Minerals, right? You know, we run this company through our process all the time because it stacks up really well. It has an amazing balance sheet. you know, $2 billion odd net cash. They've got a great asset, good part of the cost curve, long life, you know, able to expand. They've got a great management team who are really conservative, do exactly what they're going to say, don't swing the bat around too much, real operational guys. But the valuation is tough. You know, we look at the valuation and can't quite get there on our lithium price assumptions. And so, you know, to buy that company with a constructive view on lithium is to take on that valuation risk, which is something we're not always comfortable doing. If we're bullish lithium, or if you are bullish lithium and you're a retail investor and you too maybe have that sense that valuation is pretty punchy, you could buy the commodity and get exposure
that
way.
That's good advice.
Yeah.
So that's really the first decision for a lot of investors. As you mentioned, not for you at Airlie because you're not buying the commodity directly, but for everyday investors, commodity or commodity producer.
Yep.
Then I guess the second question and where we want to drill in is what are the hallmarks of a good company, a good investment in this sector?
The hallmarks of a good company are, you know, the things we talked about in our process. Good management team, a great long life asset, you know, in the right part of the cost curve, attractive valuation with a strong balance sheet. You know, that those four things make for a good company. A good investment, you know, is slightly different in that you're trying to identify where those attributes are perhaps mispriced. That's how I'd think about it. You know, with regards to asset quality, again, I can't labour this enough. It's about where your asset is on the cost curve that enables it to earn a return on capital through the cycle that you think's attractive. There are people who will buy super high cost assets in any commodity with the view that if the price rebounds significantly, there's a lot of leverage there. I totally get that. You know, that's sort of not my wheelhouse.
to be honest,
because I don't think you may be properly getting compensated for the downside risk that the business needs to raise capital, things like that. Also, the one other thing I think is worth touching on is you can get exposure to resources, through the commodity itself or through mining companies. You know, another great way to get exposure to resources sectors are the service providers of the resources industry. You know, they're companies we look at a lot. You know, companies that maybe provide the production inputs like explosives, companies that provide the labor, companies that provide the equipment. You know, these businesses can be, aren't always, in fact, a lot aren't, but can be more production linked than price linked, which means that you should have probably a more stable entity, you know, than a mining company that's subject to the whims of the commodity price. You know, if all you do is sell explosives to an iron ore business like BHP, you're probably not at the whims of the commodity price because at the end of the day, that BHP iron ore business is profitable, you know, at much lower iron ore prices. They're still going to keep producing. They need to produce a certain amount of tons every year. You know, you're actually pretty stable business if you're able to sell them that product over and over again every year. So that's another way we think about resources.
So Joe, let's turn to some companies that you're either invested in or excited about.
Yes,
we love going and understanding what opportunities are out there. So thinking about those hallmarks of a good investment, give us a company. We'll start with what it does.
Yeah.
And then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I know I'm going to, you know, like, oh, I've been listening to the podcast, hoping this resources guy fires off some some speculative mining company no one's ever heard of that we can pile into. Unfortunately, I don't have that. I have Seven Group. So Seven Group's a core holding in our fund. It has been for a while. It still is because we think it still looks attractive. But the reason we're attracted to that business, acknowledging that it is a conglomerate of many businesses, is for a business called Westrac. Westrac is the exclusive supplier of Caterpillar gear to mining companies in WA and New South Wales. If you are a mining company in either of those states and you want to buy a new piece of Caterpillar gear, you have to buy it through Westrac. You know, it's truly a privileged asset in that sense. Caterpillar runs their model as a dealership model. They're the OEM. They basically give dealers around the world the exclusive right to certain territories, and it's up to that dealer to build a profitable business, you know, selling that gear to the prospective customers. And, you know, where else would you want to sell this gear than in WA?
Yeah.
We have some of the most profitable mining companies globally with attractive regulatory environment. So, you know, for that reason, it's a great business. And I think the reason, you know, everybody knows that, it's not like that's a secret. I think that the nuance with Westrac has been that it used to look quite a cyclical business because, you know, selling new gear to mining companies is inherently linked to the CapEx cycle of a mining company, which is also linked to the price cycle. What Westrack's been able to do is actually switch the mix of revenue away from the sales of new gear towards sort of parts and maintenance. Now, parts and maintenance is much less linked to the capex cycle of a mining company, is far more linked to the regular production that needs to be maintained for a business, you know, and subsequently the wear and tear on a piece of gear through the year and the age of the fleet. You know, Australia over the last decade has just seen the age of its mining fleet get older, which means more maintenance. And as a result, over the last decade, you know, Westrack now is far more a production-linked business because it relies, because its revenue mix is far more based on parts, maintenance, and labour around that. And as a result, you know, we think it's a much more stable business than perhaps the market does. We think there's a lot of growth there as companies like BHP and Rio extend the life of their mining fleet, you know, for another 10 years, arguably ahead of the need to maybe switch into electric or battery-powered vehicles. And so we think there's just a long runway for growth. You know, I love this stock. So I could talk about it all day because there are other parts to the thesis around Boral and around Coates.
Well, I was going to ask that because, you know, with these conglomerates, you might have like a gem of an asset that you love, but you can't just buy that asset. You've got to buy the whole thing. And Seven Group, for people unfamiliar, Kerry Stokes's vehicle. Now his son's vehicle as well. It owns Boral, Beach Coates. Energy, yeah. Coates. Yeah. So Seven I guess West. give us the full view of what Seven Group is.
That's a good idea. Maybe it's best if I just put it through the early process to show sort of listeners how it stacks up. So starting with balance sheet, they're under 2x leverage, which we think is perfectly acceptable for a business of this quality. In terms of business quality, so the business is... most of the valuation comes from three businesses. That's Westrack. You know, that business does a 30% return on capital. As I was just saying, it's much more stable than it has been in history. It's growing. An incredibly high-quality business. We have Coates. Coates is an equipment hire business. You know, again, these businesses aren't generally thought of as super high-quality, but Coates has delivered, you know, a 15% return on capital last few years. They're managing to sort of drive margins higher and higher through utilization, through improving the network, through just sort of really simple operational improvements, well executed. And then you have Boral. So again, Boral, Australia's largest, you know, concrete and cement manufacturer. This is a business that is in the midst of a turnaround at the hands of Vic Bansal, who's, you know, an executive we think really highly of from an operational perspective. And a business that, frankly, with its market position, should earn a much higher return on capital than it has done over the past decade. And so, you know, we look at those three businesses and we think, you know, these are great assets. They should earn a return on capital higher than that of the average ASX industrial business. And yet, Seven Group trades on a multiple equal to that of the ASX industrials business. You know, for context, that's around 19x. The average ASX industrial business does a 12% return on capital. You know, you got three businesses within Seven Group that all do higher than that. Well, in the case of Boral, should do and will do higher than that. And yet we can pay the same multiple as the market. You know, you overlay then the management quality factor. You know, I think the Stokes family over the last 5 years, Ryan Stokes in particular, have proven themselves as capital allocators. You know, he was able to basically buy Boral without putting a takeover premium in place on market, you know, a really attractive valuation and generate a lot of, you know, value as a result. They're managing Westrack and Coates really sensibly. Those businesses just keep going from strength to strength. And then, you know, I think finally, the earnings of Seven Group as a conglomerate have probably or will double basically over the last 5 years from, say, maybe FY19 to FY24. The corporate overhead at Seven Group is $30 million. You know, 5 years ago, it was $25 million. Like, this isn't News Corp with a $200 million overhead, you know, that doesn't make sense to anyone, and there's all these governance issues around it. And for context, we own News Corp for different reasons. but you know, I think there's a lot to be said about how these guys run their business. You go to the Seven Group offices, you know, they're not in the Paris end of the Sydney CBD. They're on Liverpool Street. It's, you know, like half of a serviced office. There's maybe like under 10 people who actually work in the Seven Group overhead. You know, they're very astute operators as well as capital allocators. And, you know, frankly, they're not taking the piss, which is just something, you know, as an investor, you really want to see. And then, of course, you know, they own 60% of the business.
Mm.
They're incredibly aligned with any minority shareholder. And again, we still think the valuation relative to the quality of the businesses within the conglomerate is super attractive.
Mm. Nice. Yeah. Including the media business?
Well, the good thing about the media business is it's 1% of the valuation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. Because that, yeah, that's obviously been struggling. But I, like, what I will say is it's not like, because it's 1% of valuation, Ryan gives it no focus.
Yeah.
You know, he'll speak to it in depth. He's trying to turn it around. Which is impressive, you know. It's not just this non-core, oh, don't worry about it, you know.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, love that. That's a fascinating look at a company that I'm sure a lot of people have probably heard about. Yeah. Everyone heard about it with the Boral takeover.
Yeah.
But I'm sure a lot of people haven't really considered it as an investment.
The only other thing I'd say on Seven Group is, like, you know, now that you have this great track record of capital allocation, given the balance sheet is not particularly levered, you sort of back them to go again.
I was going to ask that. We always like to finish with, like, a long term. What does this company look like in 10 years if they execute successfully?
And I think the good thing is, you know, ultimately, nothing is sacred in Seven Group. Mm-hmm. You know, if they can see an opportunity to create value by selling a business, they will. And then on the flip side, they have the leverage to go again. Mm. They have the balance sheet position to go again. And you back them to do it sensibly with the, you know, with the shareholders front of mind, and create value. And that's been the experience for us as shareholders, and there's no reason that we don't think that will continue.
Watch this space.
Yeah.
You always love, like, the succession of, like, father to son is always, like, a risk point where it's like, does the son want to go out there and do a big deal to prove himself?
Oh.
But it feels like this Boral deal was that for Ryan.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he did probably, you're right. He did, you know, they took back 50% of Coats from private equity, you know, years before that. They obviously bought the Beach stake. You know, both of those have proven to be pretty good investments. Boral, it was a big go, right?
Yeah,
and they took leverage above where most people would be comfortable, I'd say. They took it above 3x, and they paid it back quicker than anybody thought they ever could, and the earnings of Boral have probably exceeded many people's expectations. So it's hard not to say that Ryan hasn't proven himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating company, definitely one that we'll keep watching.
And, I'll come back next time with a speculative mining.
We're looking forward to that, Joey, but thank you so much. That does bring us to the end of our chat today.
No worries.
It's been great learning about your journey in finance and, you know, how you're thinking about applying the early approach to the resources sector. So thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Cool. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to an EquityMates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, EquityMates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. EquityMates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services License 540697.